This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with Randy Young, founder and director of La Tierra del Jaguar. Could you describe La Tierra del Jaguar and how you came to found it?
The easiest way to do that would probably be to start a few years ago. I got invited to manage a jaguar reserve in Sonora, Mexico. I worked there for about 3.5 years. I started out trying to modify the job to fit the project and wound up deciding to step down from the job to be able to make La Tierra del Jaguar be its own independent organization. We're now a 501c3, and the focus is to try to save the jaguar through helping the human change how we do agriculture and how we live overall. That's the biggest thing I saw, was that the need to work with people and the land in general. The land has been way overgrazed for too many years by the way we do agriculture in the region. Because of that, nature is also losing out, so you end up with less deer, less javelina, less of the feed animals for jaguars. And so the jaguar ends up with very little to eat but cattle. And any cattle loss at all is a big loss to the ranchers of the region. These are generally folks that are pretty much subsistence living off their ranches. And so whenever they do lose a calf or a cow, quite often retaliation is made towards the predators in the area, whatever they may be, whether that be by sending out hunters or by poisoning carcasses or whatever means it may be. And it's not that there's a hatred for the jaguar. It's more just a basic need. And whenever loss is felt, the human response is to go after whatever caused that loss. And a lot of the times what we need to do is go back to look at what we've done to cause that loss. And that's kind of what I'm focusing on, is working on starting with landscape restoration work and then working through several different forms of regenerative agriculture in order to modify the human's behavior enough to be able to start partnering with nature, and in that way completely turn the tables to a feeling of abundance that is also felt by nature around us. And technically it's the same processes that are needed to work against climate change. So these same processes can have larger effects than even in our region. So jaguars travel over hundreds of miles, the males at least. So reserves do a great job of giving them a breeding ground or an area that they may be safe in, but they're going to travel outside those bounds. And when they do, the most important thing is the relationships with those neighboring ranchers and with those things. And most reserves do a good job of trying to work with the ranchers around them, but the jaguar travels in a really big area and their means are limited, you know, both time and resources in every way. So the focus of this project is more based in the communities than out on the jaguar reserves. So this is based close to the communities where we can create a demonstration site and really show what regenerative agriculture can do, so that people driving by see, you know, a couple horses standing in knee-high grass and decide that they want to take on those techniques that right now just seem like a lot of work for no results. Right now we've brought in experts before and people see the work and they'll just say that those processes won't work here. And if you don't implement processes completely, you're absolutely right. If you do, you know, rock work or landscape work, but you don't keep the cattle off of it so the plants can't regenerate, you'll never see the benefit of that landscape work. I mean, you may reduce erosion a little bit, but you won't have increased actual biodiversity and you know, plant matter for the herbivores to eat. So it's very critical to have a place where you can see the processes functioning and see how they overlap and how they work together, because all of these different systems are very symbiotic.
Your artistic journey and your path to conservation are intertwined. Could you tell us about your trajectory as an artist and how that's touched your trajectory as a conservationist?
It's been an interesting walk, yes. Grew up in Silver City, New Mexico. In my neighborhood, there was a ceramic shop and a university, and the security guards would run me off really quick from the university. So I hung out at the ceramic shop a lot, and I started working for the lady, you know, just pouring molds, and she'd give me candies and stuff in exchange. Then I pulled some old molds that hadn't been poured in a long time, and they had water dripped in them, so they had pitting in the plaster molds. And I was recarving the clays for those to be able to fix the molds. And some college students, to me they were adults, but I realize now they were like 18-year-old college students, you know, saw me doing that work and invited me to go to their sculpture classes at the university. And of course, I got really excited and I went with them. And the professor was like, this is not a daycare. You can't be here. Go home. And after 3 days of that, he finally let me stay. He said, there'll be no horseplay in my class. I'm not cleaning up after you. And don't throw anything in my class. And that was it. Oh, and I won't repeat anything. That was his third thing. And I got to stay. And by age 11, I had cast bronze. I had made my own clays. I had done my own slips, multiple artistic processes. And then we moved to Lordsburg, New Mexico, and art died. My dad bought me a kiln, and it never worked. And so from there, I became a master auto mechanic. I got myself a hot rod so I could get out of that town and started doing mechanic work. I became a master auto mechanic and wound up having to support my mom for years. So just completely shut down the art side and turned a lot of wrenches for a lot of years there. And then got really lucky and my kidneys shut off from petroleum toxicity. And I had to quit the auto dealerships. And that was one of the most valuable things that's ever happened to me. Since then, I started guiding, doing outdoor guiding, hiking and mountain biking. And started Sculpture Resource Center, a local sculpture collective that I ran for a lot of years. And really was able to open up all the different parts of my being. And during that time at Sculpture Resource Center, that was a really valuable time. I did a lot of different work in the community and a lot of different artwork and started doing some work with teaching for charter schools and different things like that. So that really bridged a lot. And I didn't have money and I was too scared to start a nonprofit at the time. So I started a business at Sculpture Resource Center, even though it was a bad business because it was for artists. And so I went to Pima and took business classes and marketing classes and all kinds of stuff and lived under the stairs at Sculpture Resource Center. And that's how I funded that place for quite a few years. After a few years of that, I had to step down because after a while, you start to get resentful of paying the difference in the rent every month and cleaning the bathroom. So I stepped down. There was enough membership to carry the place. So I stepped down, gave it to the membership, and moved out to the country to start a little sustainable homestead. I designed concrete walls for houses and landscapes that hold water, and so there are passive heating and cooling, emergency water supply, water harvesting containment systems, all in a visual way that can be designed into the architecture of a structure. I put that on Kickstarter and tried to get funding, and I'd had a couple different private funders, but it just never quite was enough to get the process really perfected and be able to get some usable prototypes so we could start marketing it. So after working on that and it not funding through Kickstarter, I was looking for what was next, but I couldn't just get a regular job. I had to make a difference in this world. So that's when I was working for Arizona Trail Association doing youth mentorship stuff, taking high school and junior high groups out, doing stewardship work on the Arizona Trail. The boss from that and the boss from the Northern Jaguar Project, the reserve there, are friends. And so he mentioned casually that he was going mountain biking on a jaguar reserve in Mexico. And I immediately was like, can I go too? And he sunk the hook and said he'd have to ask. Came back a little while later and said that they said yes. And by the way, they're looking for a new reserve manager. And I said, if I meet any jaguar reserve managers, I'll let you know. But it turned out that after a week of being on the reserve doing this wonderful mountain biking adventure, it turned out that all the needs that they had and my skill sets aligned. I did that work for 3.5 years, and now I'm working on the next phase of that, which is La Tierra del Jaguar. And I think all of this has been done with kind of an artistic viewpoint. I'm not a biologist. I'm not an academic. I'm somebody who just works with his hands and his brain and makes what he needs to make. And so all of this has kind of come from my gumption and the need I see and my ability to create. I was fortunate enough to receive a grant from the Arts Foundation to create a trio of murals, I guess would be how you would phrase it. It's going to be the same mural in Tucson, in Hermosillo, Sonora, and in Sahuaripa, Sonora. And that mural is for La Tierra del Jaguar. There'll be a big jaguar head on one side, and then the logo for La Tierra del Jaguar, and then a couple jaguars that are jaguar people that are standing there like they just finished painting the mural, waiting to take their selfie with you. So it's a selfie opportunity, and I hope everybody will find that mural and take some selfies with it. It's about exposure to the fact, first of all, that the jaguar is in our region. A lot of people don't realize that right here in Tucson, we are in the land of the jaguar. Early 1800s, the jaguar still reached all the way up into the Grand Canyon and Colorado. 1700s, they were clear up in Missouri. So, you know, the jaguars are our biggest cat. We have to let them come back and help them to come back. And in order to do that, it takes a lot of different effort and a lot of different work. And the biggest thing is changing how we interact with nature and seeing that nature is our partner and that without nature, we can't live.
The jaguar has clearly inspired many people here in the borderlands. It's become a symbol that I think maybe means different things to different people, but it's very motivating and inspiring for sure. What do you think about the jaguar's capacity to inspire, and what does it mean to you?
I was a young man in New Mexico whenever the jaguar was reintroduced or rediscovered in the U.S., Warner Glenn's photos, and it immediately made the mountains that I grew up in more wild to me. It changed my feeling of that. And the jaguar transcends people's ideas of just nature into the mystical and mythical. The jaguar has a power through its strength, through its beauty, through its traveling at night. There's so many things about the jaguar that just mystify the human. They always have. That's why they were a god to so many peoples and still are. I feel like the jaguar called me to do this work, and I feel like I need to step up and deserve that. So I feel like there's a lot of work to be done in order to really help the jaguar revive in the whole area here and be strong again in the area and have people appreciate the jaguar and through it appreciate nature, because it is our bond to nature that can keep us alive now. And the more that we take on these different regenerative techniques and these ways of life of sustainability, and I like to say sustainability still leaves a stain. So we got to try to get to regenerative. We got to try to build back what we have. I think that seeing someone like that as a hero, as like the jaguar is, you know, as gives you something to strive for and a reason to step up and try to do more. Because there's so much around us now that can just drive you down to where you don't have the energy to try to keep fighting. So I think things like this are critical to make that happen. And in the long term, I think the jaguar will be able to be a symbol that can help spread these techniques. Because I think people will come to the processes and the systems of what we're doing through the murals, through the different things. The murals I did for the Northern Jaguar Project were some of the best work we've done down there for working with the community as far as visibility. So I think that the arts have the ability to really put these issues in people's faces in a way that people embrace as opposed to standing back from and being scared of. So I think that's the magic of the arts and how they can really help the jaguar and how the jaguar can really help regenerative processes in general.
You have this really interesting project that is binational or transfrontera, right? Borderland projects in Mexico and in Tucson, in Arizona, in Southern Arizona, and in Northern Mexico. And you happen to be an embodiment of that kind of bridging as well.
Well, partly because of my skin color, but the border has always been mostly a minor inconvenience in my life. I grew up on both sides of it. Spanish was my first language. My mom's from the mountains of Chihuahua. And so I grew up a lot in Juarez, Mexico, and in New Mexico and in El Paso. And literally for years bounced back and forth across the border at El Paso. I'd live in Juarez because I was paying double rent so I could afford it with my mom, and go to the dealerships in El Paso to do work every day as an auto mechanic. And the bridge was only 15 minutes on a motorcycle, so it didn't seem that big a deal. But to some people, it's an insurmountable border that they cannot get through without risking their lives. Same thing is true for the jaguar. So I think there's a lot to work to do in multiple realms, and I think that art is one of the best ways to be able to speak to these needs.
So La Tierra del Jaguar is a project that addresses a set of problems, but with some really clear solutions, right? Some techniques that we can name.
The phrase that is most commonly used is to let the water do the work. There's actually a book by that name, and the process is about setting up rocks and stuff to create barriers to catch and slow the water, but then they catch the topsoil and the seed and start to regenerate areas. So the first thing is to work on the landscape that most of the time is going to be overgrazed or in some other way damaged. you go in and you do landscape restoration work. And then once you've done that, during that process, you're building up berms and stuff to be able to start to work on either key line or swale technologies in order to start to sink and store water in the project and really create zones and the beginnings of a system that can turn into a permaculture garden system. And then you start working with natural building techniques to build your structures, which are things like adobe, rammed earth, cob. There's multiple processes that can be used for natural building, but you're using mostly product of the land that you're on to build what you're building. So it's the least input from anywhere else necessary, so the lowest carbon footprint. And then you go into market garden systems and permaculture systems on the whole, aquaponic systems, which can grow vegetables with 10% of the water use of traditional systems. So all of these systems start to stack on each other. Some of your zones, your external zone on these types of permaculture systems is designed as a buffer zone. It's an area that maybe you grow your timber in and stuff like that, but overall, it's that zone that nature is allowed to feed in and to harvest some of your abundance in. And you consider that part of the mix, if you do a good job of that, you don't need quite as strong of fences to keep them out because you're giving them something to survive on. If everything's barren around you, I don't care what your fence looks like, they're coming in. Everything must eat. So all of these different systems stack and work with each other in order to really create the most abundance. And after a short time, you truly do have abundance.
When did you establish La Tierra del Jaguar as a 501c3?
The application was sent in February, so that's what the date on the paperwork says now. But it was, I believe, mid-April that the paperwork came in and we got approved. So it's a brand new nonprofit. And as such, we really need to build that donor base and get people to know what we're doing and know about the work we're doing, because it is kind of a different take on conservation. Most folks think if you just buy land, you're conserving, you know, you're creating a conservation project and that's all you need. And that is a huge benefit and they're very valuable. But, you know, it's kind of, if you are trying to protect a salamander that stays in one puddle, you buy the puddle and you're good. But if you're trying to protect something that travels over hundreds of miles, you've got to work a lot with those communities in order to make those animals and nature in general be seen as a benefit and as a need. And that's kind of what the focus of this is. And that can only happen through economic opportunities as well. If you tell people don't do that whenever they have little, they're not going to listen to that. If you tell people, if we do this, it'll be better, they'll step up. People want change. They just don't know the directions to take to get there. And that's kind of the biggest part of this project, is to plant the seeds and then let people carry those seeds home and grow them in their own ways. So all of the systems that we're working on are not only regenerative systems, but we're working on creating replicable systems that people can learn and take to their communities or their areas, their reserves, whatever it may be, and implement those systems as a whole and create change wherever they are.
Scalable and replicable.
Yes, that's critical in order to be able to make any of these changes really matter and take place. And that's one of the things over time, the Jaguar will help attract the interest. And then once people arrive and are interested, they'll be able to take these things home and carry them with pride, because they know that there's the power of the Jaguar behind it, as opposed to just, you know, I really want to do something neat for the world. Like, this is much more powerful. I think it's easy to get passionate about, and that's really critical when you're trying to create change. And I think it's important, too, that we realize that when we say nature's all around us, that we're also talking about each other. You know, we try to separate ourselves from that picture too much, I think. And, you know, some of the scariest things I know are public buildings. So I think it's very important to really, you know, realize that we are in an extremely ecologically diverse region, and that means that we've got some work to do. You know, that gives us kind of a challenge. Everybody enjoys that beauty, but you don't get that beauty without a cost. You know, so I think everybody needs to realize that and kind of step up and do their part to at least make sure that your elected officials are working towards saving the areas around us, that you're doing whatever you can towards it. All the little changes in your life you can do make a difference, but some of the biggest difference we can make is by trying to pressure the corporations and stuff that we purchase from. So there's a lot of layers. So whichever stages you're able to get involved in, please do.
So being that you very recently birthed this brand new baby 501c3, that must be a very fresh memory in your mind. And you still do have kind of this infant in your arms. And you had mentioned that it was a scary concept when it had been presented to you before and you decided not to go that route. So my question is, what tipped the scale for you to make you decide to go out on that limb and do that scary thing and found your own nonprofit? And how do you think art and being an artist maybe relates to that?
Well, I think being an artist to begin with makes you realize that, especially my walk, I've been a sculptor, and so pretty much anything can be a medium in my head. I actually never did two-dimensional work. I wouldn't even sketch for my sculptures. I would sketch in clay if I was going to do a stone sculpture because I didn't think two-dimensional worked for me. My first two-dimensional paintings were murals in Sahuaripa for the Jaguar Reserve. So I think anything can be a medium, and through my work as a sculptor, I've kind of worked that a lot with playing with different mediums. And I think that made it to where the fact that I've worked with so many mediums made it simpler for me to finally take that jump and see that I can do whatever I need to do. I think a big part of it was two-staged, managing the Jaguar Reserve, moving off to the wilds of Mexico, and some of the harrowing experiences that took place while on the Jaguar Reserve and doing that work made it to where not that much scares me. You know, most things are like, okay, this is what's happening now. How am I going to get through it? And so it was much more that atmosphere, but also I had a lot of loss. Lost a couple very close people right before that change. And that just created the overwhelming need to make a difference. And through that, that was what I had to do. It was no longer what could I do, it was what do I have to do. And starting the nonprofit was no longer an option. It was what had to happen for the next steps to be able to happen. And now the scariest part is coming now, and that's asking donors to actually step up and make a difference. And so that's even scarier than starting the nonprofit or managing the Jaguar Reserve or anything else, is that stepping up and asking.
Asking for help can be a really scary experience. But I often tell people, remember that when you ask for help, allowing people to help is also giving them a gift. I think so many people here are so moved by El Jefe and having seen him in our lifetime, or amazed by the wildlife that we see or that we don't see but we know is nearby. And having an organization or a movement or an effort that is pointed towards doing something really meaningful for our environment, especially right here, right? This environment right here in the borderlands. Being able to put our money into something that actually makes a difference because there's somebody behind the wheel, that is a gift too.
That's a really valuable perspective, and it's one that's hard to think of when you're in the position of asking. That's the most difficult thing for anyone who's wanting to make a difference, is trying to gather the people around them that will help make that be.
You mentioned that one of the things that changed you were some of the harrowing situations that you had to encounter as a manager of a Jaguar Reserve.
Well, I think the one that is kind of exemplary and won't get me in any trouble in any way, is I was with a photographer and we were looking for these military macaw cliffs. And we had already spent about a week doing extreme hikes. This guy's, his name's Brendan Kahn, and he is, you know, at the time he was like 24, 25 years old and looked like he just walked off the cover of Men's Health. And we spent a week of grueling hikes, him carrying an 80-pound backpack full of photography gear and me pushing through the dense foliage of the monsoon season to be able to get to these different locations. And after about a week of it, we're almost done with our extreme adventure, and we go to this location that I wouldn't let any of the other employees drive down that road during the rainy season because it's a really bad clayey road and you might not get back out. So we went down there and we searched for these macaw cliffs and searched for these macaw cliffs and we couldn't find them. And so finally we decide that we need to get out because we're not going to find them in time. We send a message out through one of those satellite communication devices. This is a very remote area. You can't cell phone or anything from out there. So we use one of those spot devices to send out a message and let folks know that we can't find those cliffs. We need, you know, GPS coordinates. And so we go to try to get out and we charge the hill and my truck won't make it up. Multiple times I fill rocks into the holes and we can't get out. And so finally I tell him to walk to the top of the hill and he says, why? And I say, because you can't be in my truck if it falls off the cliff. And so I fill the hole with rocks again, back down the mountain and go about 3/4 of a mile down to where I can get some speed up. And I hit that mountain full speed and I bounced all over the place, almost bounced off the cliff, made it to the top and checked the vehicle. And there was some stuff majorly broken underneath the front end of that truck, but it was still drivable, barely. Of course, while I'm looking at that, we get the message with the GPS coordinates for the macaw cliff. So we have to go back down that hill. We're not taking the truck. So we hike down with as little gear as we think we need. We get down there and we find the cliff finally. It's about 1 p.m. when we find the cliffs. And you can tell where the macaw cliffs are because macaws are very loud birds. So they start telling you this is where we are. But we weren't getting good shots for quite a while. So we're there for a few hours trying to get good pictures of these macaws. And then after a while, I hear the thunder in the distance. And I let Brendan know that we need to get moving. And he says, hang on a sec, let me get a couple more. And we wait a little bit longer and we turn around. It's about 4:30 p.m. and there's a wall of black right behind us. There's this shard of a rainbow sticking out of the black wall and you can't see anything beyond it. And it was, you know, 4:30 p.m. so we weren't expecting to need lights yet. So we've got one light that managed to stay in one of our backpacks and this extreme storm comes upon us. So I'm shining the light a meter ahead of me, taking 2 steps, shining it back a meter for him to catch up. And we hike along like this, headed back towards what we think is our camp. We go for quite a ways, and I'm trying to stay far away from the river so that I don't fall off the edge down into the water. The water's raging. And after quite a while of this, I step on a big rock, and it just sloughs off down into the water with a big whoosh. And so I'm right at the edge, obviously. So we figure out a way to climb down to the edge and hike along the river's edge for a ways because we can't negotiate the top very well at that point. And after a ways, we get to a spot where we can't go forward, we can't go up. And so I turn to him and I say, we're going to have to stay here tonight. Neither one of us wanted to hear or feel that, but that was what was necessary. So we climbed up the hill a ways and he pinned in behind 3 little mesquites. I got one and strapped my backpack around it to hold me up. And we were there for probably about 1 hour. I got a little bit of sleep. And then I realized that the water level was rising and we should go up a little bit further. So we crawl up this steep riverbank cliff a little bit further and get in behind some other trees about another 15, 20 feet up the hill. And we spent the whole night there with thunder hitting all around us and big boulders sloughing off the side of it into the water the whole night and lightning hitting the water and these beautiful light shows and rain coming down the whole night, both of us completely drenched. And it was one of those nights that you're not completely sure if you're going to make it or not, and you're not sure the whole night. It's not like it's a 20-minute time frame that you're not sure. It's over and over again. You know, I managed to get a good amount of sleep. He said he counted to 1,000 over and over again all night. But I managed to get quite a bit of sleep in little spurts. But then I'd get woken up by another giant chunk of lightning or a giant rock falling off into the water. And at this point, I'm comfortable sleeping anywhere. It doesn't matter where it's at. The chances are the circumstances aren't going to be that bad. So that was one of those harrowing experiences.
No wonder you just went ahead and started a 501c3.
Not all that scary at this point.
Thank you for being here today, Randy.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me in.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County.